Vietnam's Iran calls U.S. unilateralism a threat to global peace and stability, and China says the international community has no option but to fight unilateralism and bullying. The U.S. president moves to declassify some documents about the 9/11 attacks as the victims' families push for a probe into the FBI's, quote, lost evidence. Also coming up, several British police officers are injured and 10 people arrested during an anti-vaccine protest in London. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour: the Iranian foreign minister says U.S. unilateralism is a threat to global peace and stability. During a phone conversation with his Chinese counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdollahian reiterated Iran's opposition to the world powers' interference in other countries. The Chinese foreign minister, Wang Yi, also stressed that the international community has no option but to fight unilateralism and bullying. Both sides agreed that the United States is to blame for the current chaotic situation in Afghanistan. The United States has sanctioned what is called four intelligence operatives for an alleged kidnapping plot on U.S. soil. The U.S. Treasury Department said the sanctions target all property of four individuals in the United States or in U.S. control and prohibits all transactions with them. The Iranians were charged with a plot to abduct an anti-Tehran figure for rendition to Iran in July. Back then, former Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif called the charges, quote, patently ridiculous and childishly conceived. He said the accusations were aimed at covering up Washington's criminal ties to gunmen hatcheting plots in the U.S. to assassinate leaders in Venezuela and Haiti. U.S. President Joe Biden has signed an executive order that could result in the declassification of new documents about the 9/11 attacks. The decree directs federal agencies to begin a six-month process to declassify documents related to the FBI's investigations into the 2001 attacks. The move comes ahead of the 20th anniversary of the incident that claimed nearly 3,000 lives in the U.S. The victims' families have been demanding a probe into whether the FBI lied about or destroyed evidence linking Saudi Arabia to the terrorist attacks. 15 of the 19 hijackers who smashed aircrafts into the World Trade Centers in New York and the Pentagon building in Washington were Saudi nationals. Political commentator Aidan Jonah says it's unlikely that U.S. intelligence agencies would open up about matters they may have been complicit in.
But you have to remember the depravity of American intelligence agencies and the American deep state apparatus more generally. So whether the intent is positive or not, I'm cynical in the sense of whether you can trust the intelligence agencies to actually open up on things where they may be complicit. Yeah, I mean, I don't think you lose documents by accident. I mean, you look at, like, countries in Afghanistan, for example, shredding documents, basically, or, of course, after the Iranian Revolution, you had, basically, the American embassy desperately trying to shred all the documents it could. Whenever people or agencies are trying to destroy documents, it's almost certain that they're trying to hide something. Well, I mean, I don't think you can really close any doors at this point. It's hard to say which aspect of that for sure, but I mean, you look at Saudi Arabia, it's been sponsoring, realistically, terrorism for so many years at this point that it's definitely not something I would cross off of the realms of possibility, for sure.
Four British police officers have been injured during protests against coronavirus vaccination of children in London. The violence erupted when a group of protesters attempted to storm the office of the UK Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency. They later moved towards central London and gathered outside the Science Museum. British police clashed with protesters and arrested 10 people. Meanwhile, Britain's vaccine advisors say they wouldn't recommend the vaccination of all 12 to 15-year-olds, that is, against COVID-19. Britain has been reporting a steady increase in coronavirus deaths since lockdown restrictions were lifted in mid-July. Scientists have also warned that infection rates will rise again following the reopening of schools. Britons are being warned to brace themselves for hikes in food prices amid mounting disruption to supply chains and shortages in the workforce. Economists are blaming the crisis on the UK's divorce from the European Union and the pandemic. Saeed Poreza has our report from the British capital.
If you live in England, chances are you're already paying more for your food. And it all begins here. Every year, tens of thousands of people come to work on UK farms from Eastern Europe. This year, the workforce is already down more than 10%. The culprit, farmers and economists say, Brexit.
We, as a farmer, are hugely passionate about employing local people, and there are many roles and career opportunities for local people here, but we simply don't have the people coming forward for the jobs.
Since Brexit, the right for EU workers to just turn up in the UK is no longer. The government quota only allows 30,000 EU labourers onto UK farms now. The industry say they need twice that number.
The cause of that shortage is a mixture of incompetence and hubris, because the British government said, oh yes, we can leave the EU, and after that everything is hunky-dory, we can rely on America.
The labour shortage is not limited to British farms only. They go across the board. The hospitality sector, for example, is 180,000 short. The meat processing sector, 5,000. When there are so many vacancies in so many different sectors in an interconnected economy, that is a problem.
One problem is in the haulage industry. Plenty of work, not enough drivers. With many waiting in long queues to take their driving tests, which stopped during COVID, creating a backlog that snowballed with Brexit, meaning the industry is now 15,000 drivers short. Some have offered a substantial pay rise for drivers to lure more people into the job. Experts say there is a problem with that.
It is far from certain that even a price rise will actually solve the solution. For a start, it's not going to bring back those EU drivers for a start. They've probably gone. So you see, the situation is bad. It doesn't look as though they can solve it at the moment. And it's going to be one of the factors of many putting up the prices very considerably in the shops.
For some industries here, COVID sent thousands of workers home. Brexit's been a big hurdle for many to come back. The one thing a post-pandemic rebound economy needs, though, is labor wherever it's from. And as long as this chronic shortage of labor exists, the average Briton will feel the pinch at the cash register. Saeed Poreza, London.
Turning to news in Afghanistan now, Taliban sources say the country has taken full control of the country, including the Panjshir Valley, where they were engaged in heavy fighting with opposition forces. Celebratory gunfire was heard in the capital, Kabul, as a Taliban commander revealed that forces loyal to Panjshir leader Ahmed Massoud had been defeated. The Taliban are yet to make an official statement, but Ahmed Massoud has rejected the news, saying losing the valley would be his last day in Panjshir. It is the only territory in Afghanistan which has put up resistance against the Taliban. They quickly swept through Afghanistan in mid-August, days after the U.S. announced it was withdrawing from the country after 2 decades. All American troops and those from allies have already left the country. Now, Iran's foreign ministry has urged all sides to the conflict in Afghanistan's Panjshir Valley to exercise restraint and to avoid a return to violence and fratricide. The ministry spokesman called on the Taliban and forces loyal to Panjshir's leader to engage in talks to obtain a mutually agreed solution. Saeed Khatibzadeh said Iran believes that only intra-Afghan talks away from foreign interference can lead to lasting peace and stability in the war-weary country. Khatibzadeh also called for a broad-based government representing the entire population in Afghanistan and its different tribes. Relatives of the victims of a last week U.S. airstrike on the Afghan capital are demanding justice. They say the airstrike has added to the list of Washington's war crimes In Afghanistan, at least 10 civilians, including 6 children, were killed in the U.S. strike. I mean, army has more.
The house was recently bombed by a U.S. drone strike. Shrapnels have even damaged the door of the house. 10 members of a single family, including 6 children, lost their lives in the recent U.S. drone strike. As the relatives of the victims say, the owner of the house, which was targeted by the attack, was an engineer with no ties to any terrorist group. Imal Ahmadi is the brother of the owner of the house. He explains how the U.S. airstrike claimed the lives of his beloved ones in a moment.
I had left the house almost 10 minutes before that U.S. brutal attack. I quickly got back after I received a call from a relative. I saw the dead bodies of my brother, his sons and daughters all over the yard.
Blaming the U.S. for launching blind attacks on civilian areas, Imal is also angry on international journalists and the United Nations for what he says turning a blind eye on their misery.
A number of local and international journalists have so far interviewed us, but no one, including the United Nations, has heard our voice. Everybody follows his or her own agenda with paying no attention to our demand. We want justice, and the UN is responsible.
It was August 30 when the U.S. airstrike hit this vehicle inside a house located in northeastern Kabul. Later, Pentagon said that they have successfully eliminated a vehicle packed with explosives in the city of Kabul. However, Taliban urgently condemned the attack, calling it an inhuman assault on civilians. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
European Union governments have drawn criticism from lawmakers and campaign groups over their response to the crisis in Afghanistan. It comes after EU foreign affairs ministers agreed to set up a regional political platform to cooperate with Afghanistan's neighboring countries. Now, critics say the decision aims to shift the burden of Afghan refugees to others. Jerome Hughes has the details.
As they stood for a photograph ahead of their latest meeting on Friday, EU foreign affairs ministers appeared to be in a jovial mood. However, critics say they have little to laugh about given the West's role in the Afghan crisis. At a press conference following the meeting, it was made clear the EU is not encouraging Afghan refugees to travel to the 27-country bloc.
The own commitments of the Taliban to let people to go out if they want. But it doesn't mean that we have any kind of commitment from the member states to take care of them.
That statement is likely to enrage rights groups and aid agencies. Oxfam had already published a statement accusing the EU of turning its back on Afghan refugees. European Commission data suggests 3.5 million people are currently internally displaced within the country. 1 in 3 are going hungry. 500,000 people are currently trying to leave Afghanistan, according to the Commission. EU lawmakers say it's not fair for the EU to place the responsibility of refugees on neighbouring countries like Pakistan and Iran.
Make sure that they have and they will own their migration crisis and that we stay away from that as best we can. I think that is hypocritical at best.
A coordinated strategy by the EU to the refugee crisis is urgently required, experts argue.
If the European Union was able to react, to respond to the refugee challenge collectively, the individual burden for every single country would be much lower.
The role the EU, NATO, Britain and the US played in Afghanistan has been castigated in the European Parliament.
The Americans lied to their people. The Americans spent over $2.2 trillion, and over $2 trillion of it went to private contractors.
One legislator suggests the EU misjudged the level of support that exists for the Taliban.
They obviously were appealing for many in Afghanistan, because otherwise they hadn't taken over the country so quickly.
Without assistance from the international community, European Commission officials forecast medical supplies will run out in Kabul within 2 weeks, and 120 children in the country could die every single day. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Now, Damascus has called on the United Nations to condemn the Israeli regime's attacks on Syrian territory. The Syrian Foreign Ministry made the call in letters addressed to the UN Secretary General and the President of the Security Council. It's urged the international bodies to assume their responsibilities to hold Israel accountable and prevent the repetition of such attacks. The plea came a day after Syrian air defenses responded to an Israeli airstrike near the capital, Damascus. The regime regularly targets positions inside Syria, especially those of the resistance forces who have played a key role in fighting foreign-backed terrorism. One of Iraq's most influential clerics, Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Mohammed Said al-Hakim, has passed away. In this report, we have taken a closer look at the noble life of the late cleric.
One of Iraq's most senior Shia clerics, Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Mohammed al-Hakim, died at the age of 87 in the holy city of Najaf. Hakim's office announced that he died of a sudden medical condition. Born in Najaf, Hakim was considered to be among the highest Shia religious authorities in the country. He was a member of the well-known and highly revered Hakim family of Shia scholars. He was the son of Ayatollah Muhammad Ali al-Hakim, a grandson of Sayyid Ahmad al-Hakim, and the grandnephew of Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Muhsin al-Hakim. His second cousin, Sayyid Ammar al-Hakim, formerly led the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, one of the largest Shia political parties in the country. Born in 1934, Hakim started his early education at the age of 5. His great father, Ayatollah Muhammad Ali al-Hakim, started teaching him from the introductory subjects like Arabic literature, grammar and logic, eloquence, as well as jurisprudence and its fundamentals. Besides, he learned from Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Muhsin al-Hakim and attended many of his jurisprudence classes. Ayatollah Hussein al-Hilli and Sayyid Abu al-Ghassim al-Khoui were also among his teachers. Hakim wrote many books, including A Message to the People in the West and Religious Dialogues. Some of his books have been translated into several languages.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. President Biden declared on Tuesday, 31st of August, that the war in Afghanistan is now over in an address that was less a celebration of a mission accomplished than a somber eulogy for a 20-year endeavor that cost the country much, but whose burden was borne by few. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Washington Post journalists Ashley Parker and Anne Geeran. The piece is titled, Declaring Afghan War Over, Biden Defends Evacuation Efforts. Stay with us for more of Ashley Parker and Anne Geeran's article. President Biden declared on Tuesday, 31st of August, that the war in Afghanistan is now over in an address that was less a celebration of the mission accomplished than a somber eulogy for a 20-year endeavor that cost the country much, but whose burden was borne by few. From the White House, Biden gave a grim speech to mark the conclusion of a grim conflict, alternately offering explanation, defiance, and justification as he reiterated that it was time to end this war and promising anyone who attacks America that we will hunt you down. But Biden also recognized the criticism that accompanied the war's chaotic ending, taking pains to reject the contention that in orchestrating a frenzied exit from Afghanistan, he had abandoned Americans and vulnerable Afghans to the mercies of the Taliban. Speaking in mid-afternoon on Tuesday, rather than a prime-time slot that might have been expected to mark the end of a two-decade war, Joe Biden argued that President Donald Trump, in signing the initial withdrawal deal with the Taliban, had left him only two options: honoring that deal or reneging and sending in thousands more troops. That was the choice, the real choice, between leaving and escalating, Biden said. I was not going to extend this forever war, and I was not extending a forever exit. Biden's speech followed nearly a month of chaotic images from inside Afghanistan, after the Taliban seized control of the country far more swiftly than the president and his advisors anticipated. It also came less than a week after a suicide bomb attack at Kabul airport, which left 13 U.S. service members and more than 100 Afghan citizens dead. He lauded the extraordinary success of this mission, framing the evacuation effort as a historic accomplishment, but there was little in his address that was ebullient or exultant, either in substance or delivery. President Biden has faced rebukes even from allies over the as many as 200 Americans still stranded in Afghanistan, as well as the turbulent execution of his exit strategy. And he devoted a good part of his remarks to pushing back on the narrative that he was leaving Americans behind in a treacherous battlefield. For those remaining Americans, there is no deadline, Biden said. We remain committed to get them out if they want to come out. He spoke of the thousands of people his administration helped to evacuate in the final days. The more than 5,500 Americans, the roughly 2,500 locally employed U.S. Embassy staffers and their families, the thousands of Afghan translators and interpreters who worked alongside Americans during the war. Most of those who remain are dual citizens, long-time residents who had earlier decided to stay because of their family roots in Afghanistan, Biden said. The White House said 98% of Americans wishing to leave Afghanistan have been evacuated. Republicans are divided over the wisdom of leaving Afghanistan, with some arguing for a long-term commitment and others saying the time has come to cut America's losses. But they have coalesced around the message that Biden is shamefully abandoning Americans, and House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, a Republican from California, demanded before the address, "What is the plan to get Americans out?" Kevin McCarthy added, "Never in my lifetime would I ever believe America would have an administration knowingly make a decision to leave Americans behind, whereas just 2 weeks ago, the president promised this nation that he would not leave until every single American was out." Biden spoke emphatically at moments, almost shouting the first part of his speech, and in a whispery hush at others, lowering his voice to make a point. At times he drummed his index finger on the lectern, as if to physically hammer home the arguments that he's been making since announcing the withdrawal this year, while declaring, "I take responsibility for the decision." The president also seemed eager to preempt and rebut his critics, at points doing so explicitly. Some say we should have started mass evacuations sooner, and couldn't this have been done in a more orderly manner? I respectfully disagree, Biden said. The bottom line is there is no evacuation from the end of a war that you can run without the kinds of complexities, challenges and threats that we faced. None. He added, to those asking for a third decade of war in Afghanistan, I ask, what is the vital national interest? We succeeded in what we set out to do in Afghanistan over a decade ago. Then we stayed another decade. Biden returned again to the core arguments he had deployed throughout the withdrawal debate, that the war had long since run its course, that American national security objectives were accomplished years ago, including the 2011 killing of Osama bin Laden, that the Afghans need to govern and defend for themselves, and that any extension of the war would only serve to put more Americans in harm's way. Biden, in effect, sought to turn the criticism on its head, saying his hasty withdrawal reflected a deep concern for the armed forces. He stressed the cost of the war for military families and said, the departure would allow the United States to focus on its true adversaries, China and Russia. When I hear that we could have or should have continued the so-called low-grade effort in Afghanistan at low risk to our service members, at low cost, I don't think enough people understand how much we have asked of the 1% of this country who put that uniform on, who are willing to put their lives on the line in defense of our nation, Biden said. President Joe Biden spoke of the physical toll the war has taken, from lost limbs to traumatic brain injuries, and the emotional one, from divorce to missed birthdays. He cited the 18 U.S. veterans a day, on average, who commit suicide. There's nothing low-grade or low-risk or low-cost about any war, he said. It's time to end the war in Afghanistan. Biden also made sure to cite Donald Trump's deal with the Taliban to leave the country by 1st of May, albeit without mentioning the former president by name, as a way of highlighting that many Republicans, including some who have been critical of his execution, have supported the decision to end the war in Afghanistan. More broadly, Biden reiterated his argument that America's priorities now lie elsewhere, and that 20 years on, the terrorist threat has metastasized in ways that make an ongoing military presence in Afghanistan unnecessary and counterproductive. The United States invaded Afghanistan in response to the 11th of September 2001 terrorist attacks to strike back at Al-Qaeda terrorists responsible for the assault. But things have become unrecognizable in two decades, Biden said. The fundamental obligation of a president, in my opinion, is to defend and protect America, not against threats of 2001, but against threats of 2021 and tomorrow, Biden said. Still, it is unclear whether, in the vacuum left by the U.S. withdrawal, Afghanistan's jagged mountains will again become a safe haven for terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. The United States will also need to find ways to continue its intelligence-gathering capabilities, now with far fewer underground operatives in Afghanistan. Questions also remain about what the Afghanistan under Taliban rule will look like. Many foreign policy experts predict that the so-called softer Taliban 2.0, which has promised, for instance, to respect the rights of women, will not be dissimilar from the organization that came before it. Biden said the United States will continue the fight against terrorism in Afghanistan and other countries. We just don't need to fight a ground war to do it, he said. Not everyone was swayed. In a statement after the speech, Republican Senator Ben Sasse, Republican from Nebraska, a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, slammed what he called Joe Biden's unseemly victory lap as detached from reality. His callous indifference to the Americans he abandoned behind enemy lines is shameful, Senator Ben Sasse said. He promised the Taliban that our troops would leave by his arbitrary 31st of August deadline, and he promised the American people that our troops would stay until every American was out. He kept his promise to the Taliban, and he lied to the American people. Biden, meanwhile, said the United States should learn from its mistakes over two decades of war in Afghanistan, and shortly after his speech, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked whether the president had identified any of his own mistakes that could provide lessons. I think the president has been pretty clear that we all had an expectation that the Afghan National Security Forces would fight harder at the end, would fight against the Taliban, Jen Psaki said. We all had an expectation that Afghan President Ashraf Ghani would not flee the country. Those were not expectations that were clearly met. In addition to being the president who ended the war in Afghanistan, Biden's legacy will also include being the U.S. leader who presided over the return of Taliban rule to Afghanistan after two decades. More than 2,400 U.S. combat deaths and trillions of dollars spent. He will also now be the president who decides whether the United States will establish a formal diplomatic relationship with the Taliban.
Food for thought.
Salam and condolences to you on the martyrdom anniversary of the survivor of the tragedy of Karbala, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him. Let us ponder on a wise statement from him. One who is content with whatever God has destined for him is the most wealthy and needless person.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. We at The Key and IRIB English Radio would like to offer our condolences to our listeners on this most grave occasion of the month of Muharram, which is the month in which Imam Hussein alayhi salam was martyred. Today, in connection with this month, we would like to speak about the philosophy of the revolution of Imam Hussein. Now, this is a very important topic, and it's a topic which has been discussed in detail and also elaborately by scholars, and due to the confines of time and the nature of our program, we cannot enter this discussion in detail. But nevertheless, we would like to mention, by way of passing, a few of the most important reasons why Imam Hussein began his revolution and why he stood up against the government of his time. The first reason we can say for his revolution was that he sought to revive the Islamic values which had been forgotten and which had been eradicated due to the efforts of the government of the Bani Umayyad, the Umayyad Caliphate. History tells us that great efforts were made by certain individuals who made an effort to eradicate certain Islamic and religious values, and replaced them with certain vices in society on an individual and social level. Imam Hussein, one of his the reasons why he stood up was to rectify this problem, and to revive those good virtues and noble virtues which Islam and the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam had made an effort to create. Another reason which has been mentioned for the uprising of Imam Hussein was that Imam Hussein sought to perform a religious obligation, which is something which is obligatory on all of us in general, and obviously upon him more specifically, and that is the obligation to enjoin the right and forbid the evil. Amr bil ma'ruf wa nahi anil munkar. In fact, in one of his letters or his last will, he mentions this specifically as being the reason why he rose up and he stood up against the government of his time. Finally, one of the reasons which has been mentioned, another reason which has been mentioned for his uprising was the formation of an Islamic government. We know that he had been invited by the people of Kufa, who had paid allegiance to him, to come, and they had they said that we are with you, and this was supposed to be the beginning of an Islamic revolution, and in turn the formation of a true divine Islamic government. So this has also been mentioned as one of the reasons why he rose and he stood up against the government of his time. In fact, in some cases, in a few cases, he explicitly mentions that the government was something that he deserved and not anybody else. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the philosophy behind the revolution of Imam Hussein. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
The Light. An Afghan woman has received the gift of life at the most unlikely time while flying. 26-year-old Sorman Nouri was on a plane bound for Birmingham when she started having contractions. She gave birth to a little girl in the altitude of 10,000 meters with the help of the cabin crew. Born in Kuwaiti airspace, the baby is named Hawa, which means Eve or air in Dari. Both mother and daughter are completely healthy. The aircraft was carrying Afghan citizens evacuated from Kabul. The passengers left behind their old lives, but they were gifted with a new one in the process. After all, life does find a way.
An Australian cyclist has become the first woman in history to pull off a front flip on a mountain bike. Caroline Buchanan landed the front flip at the OD9 cycling event in the German city of Birkenfeld. The maneuver won the former two-time Olympian the women's best trick title in the event. This was the first time the Nines featured a female category. The annual event gathers the world's best slopestyle and freeride mountain cyclists to Germany. A spectacular light show has mesmerized people in a Greek capital, Athens. 200 colorful drones performed a short harmonized display illuminating the night sky. Their colors and shapes were changing alongside music tracks. The show, organized by the Athens Cultural Center, took place 120 meters above the National Opera and Library. A French graffiti artist has created a monumental mountaintop project to encourage a more contemplative approach to life, aiming at lifting people's spirits. The giant 1,500 square meter painting is called A New Lease of Life. It was painted on the summit of Mollison Peak in the western Swiss Alps. The 32-year-old artist says he was inspired by the likeness of childlike wonder. The mural depicts a little boy blowing bubbles in an area known for its clouds. The artist says he wanted to reflect the link between children and sky gazing.
I think we live in a world that includes anxiety, and we need a little lightness to balance it. So I believe that the clouds mean dreams and imagination. When we were kids, we liked to imagine shapes in the clouds and so on. And I believe that this is a moment where we have to breathe and also imagine the world of tomorrow with a certain lightness through daydreaming.
Saip also says he designs his creations to fit in with the environment using biodegradable paints made from natural pigments. The French artist is known for his massive graffiti works on grass that are best seen from the air. Some of his other works have adorned an impoverished shanty town in South Africa and the lawn in front of the UN headquarters in Geneva. One of Mexico's largest zoos has launched a one-of-a-kind exhibition, with the star of the show being a manatee couple. Visitors will be able to see the couple at the new exhibition, which is part of the largest aquarium in the country. The zoo received the manatee couple from the Caribbean with the intention of raising awareness for the protection of the species. Part of the ticket proceeds will go toward conservation efforts. Manatees are fully aquatic, mostly herbivorous marine mammals that are sometimes known as sea cows. These funny-looking creatures are endangered because of pollution and fishing techniques.
Paleontologists in Egypt have discovered fossilized bones of an ancient whale that could probably walk on land and swim in water. Scientists found the skull, jaw, and some ribs and identified the parts as the 43-million-year-old ancestor of the modern whale. It's also the earliest type of semi-aquatic whale found in Africa. The whale is estimated to have been 10 meters in length, weighing over half a ton, and was likely a top predator. Scientists say the four-legged whale is a key new species that helps trace the transition of whales from land to sea. Paleontologists believe that the ancestors of modern whales developed from deer-like mammals living on land over a 10-million-year period. The fossilized remains were discovered in Egypt's western desert, which was once covered by sea. A French beekeeper has invented a unique device to keep his beehives safe after suffering a traumatic loss of 35 of them to hungry Asian hornets. The device is a one-way mechanism that baits hornets with sugary water, and once they get in through a funnel, they never come out. Originally, the trap was made of wooden crates and metal mesh, but now they are 3D printed in plastic. Dennis made his first lobster pot to catch the hornets in 2016 and now makes the traps in bulk due to growing demand. The Asian hornets are an invasive insect that arrived in France via a pottery shipment from China. The killer hornet can eat through an entire hive in a matter of hours. There is a festive occasion for a Mexican zoo amid a rare birth boom in its lion enclosure. Keepers and visitors are amazed to hear roars of three newborn cubs. The three baby lions that are trying very hard to roar were born just 2 weeks ago in Zacango Zoo. The zookeepers separate them from their mother for a few hours a day to feed them because their mother cannot produce milk. The two female and male cubs would live under constant surveillance for a couple of months so that their health is reassured. They are reported to be currently in good health.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A bunker built by the German army in France during World War II has now been given a new lease of life by turning it into an underground guest house. A 4,300 square feet bunker located off Breton coast in northern France was originally built by Nazi troops after invading the country in 1940. The area has been the home of hundreds of such fortifications of the German army. Half of them have been buried along sandy beaches. This underground guest house now belongs to the 52-year-old bunker enthusiast. Serge Gollio says it took 18 months to dig out the buried trench and turn it into a fully functional guest house. He says an attempt was made to preserve some historic aspects during its renovation.
What is nice is to now be able to spend time here, to have dinner, to spend the night in things like this. So we adapted the bunker while preserving a certain feel. We wanted to give the building a second life, so we are not going to live in the past forever. We save some aspects, you know, where you are. There are historic cues, but this isn't a museum either.
Collio says many French visitors and foreigners, including Germans, have stayed in the guest house since the bunker opened a year ago. The world's highest expressway has opened to traffic in China's Tibet Autonomous Region. It's nearly 300 kilometers long and has an average elevation of 4,500 meters. It connects the cities of Nachu and Lhasa, shortening the travel time from 6 to 3 hours. The road passes through many picturesque areas, such as snowy mountains, grasslands, and wetlands. The expressway is also environmentally friendly. Special passages have been devised for animals to get from one side of the freeway to the other. An architectural firm in Singapore has come up with a unique idea to deal with a country's constant warm temperatures. A hotel on the island's busy business district has been covered with more than 20 species of creeping plants, to keep the place cooler. A layer of vegetation blankets the facade of the Red Tower, which is growing thicker with the passage of time. The plants reduce the ambient temperature by a combination of water evaporation and releasing cooler vapor. The architect says the tower is 10 to 20 degrees Celsius cooler than nearby buildings. The green facades also reduce harmful carbon emissions, which account for over 20% in a spiraling city.
The youngest panda at the U.S.'s Smithsonian Zoo, National Zoo that is, has turned one. Baby panda Xiao Qiji celebrates the milestone by eating a specially made fruitsicle cake with his mother, Mei Xiang, in Washington, D.C. Both pandas dug into their icy cake, an ideal treat in the hot and humid summers of the U.S. capital. Xiao has captured hearts and had many first-time experiences. Some of them include sliding and tumbling around in snow and recognizing his name, which translates to little miracle in English.
He was born during the pandemic, and given the age of his mother, we didn't think she'd have another cub. And the fact that we, not just that we had this miracle, but he has just been, he's given people moments of pure joy and pure happiness.
Xiao Qiji is the fourth surviving cub of Mei Xiang. Its older siblings now live in China under an agreement with the United States. Pandas have been reclassified from endangered to vulnerable thanks to reforestation to expand habitats in which the species can survive. There are an estimated 1,800 giant pandas in the wild.
The annual Buddha sculpture has been unveiled at the New York State Fair to the delight of eager spectators. The artwork was sponsored for the 53rd year by the American Dairy Association. It was carved out of 400 kilograms of butter and took 10 days to build. The sculpture is dedicated to the children who will be going back to their normal lives after the coronavirus pandemic is over. Once the fair ends, all of the butter will be broken down and turned into renewable energy. Switzerland is constructing its biggest alpine solar plant in an effort to secure renewable energy throughout the year. The 2.2 megawatt plant is expected to be completed by the end of 2021. The Mutzi site will include nearly 5,000 solar modules and produce around 3.3 million kilowatt hours of electricity. It will have the option of delivering half of its production during the winter when temperatures drop to sub-zero levels in Switzerland. The developers say the project makes more environmental than fiscal sense. Currently, the country gets less than 4% of its electricity from solar power. An eatery in Japan is giving disabled people a new lease on life by including them in its workforce. Dawn Cafe uses robotic staff controlled remotely by people who are handicapped. Around 50 people with mental and physical disabilities help run the cafe. The pilots come from all over Japan as well as overseas. The venue was established with support from major companies and crowdfunding. It has become more than just a place to eat for its customers.
Customers here are not exactly coming to this location just to meet the Orihime robots. They come here because of the people behind Orihime, and they will come back to see them again.
For Kentaro, Dawn Cafe has a very personal touch. In his childhood, he was left unable to go to school due to a period of bad health. Now he aspires to come up with ways to further the inclusion of disabled people in society. Crowd crowds of visitors and conservationists have been delighted by the birth of a rare orangutan in the Spanish town of Fuengirola. The new residents of the safari park made his first public appearance 2 weeks after his birth. The baby, yet to be named, is the only one to be born in a European zoo over the past 12 months. The park has launched a program to conserve Bornean orangutans that are considered as a critically endangered species. Their population has declined by more than 50% over the past century. Dozens of baby turtles have made their way to the sea after an unexpected overnight hatch in Italy. Italian volunteers were surprised by track marks of the hatchlings from an unknown nest in Sicily. Some of the eggs hatched in the morning. An environmental group following the turtles' movement said that 74 hatchlings made it to the sea, while five didn't. The reptiles are an endangered species of oceanic turtle that also live in the Mediterranean Sea. Their population has declined in recent years due to hunting, loss of beach nesting sites, over-harvesting of their eggs, and being caught in fishing gear.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Amid the recent chip shortage, Dutch company ASML's products have become central to a geopolitical struggle between the United States and China, with Washington making it a high priority to block China's access to the machines. So far, the U.S. government has pressured the Dutch not to grant the export licenses needed to send the extreme ultraviolet lithography machines to China. We now present you an article written by Dave Makichuk. The piece is titled, "The $150 Million Machine That Will Change the World." The article has been published by the New York Times. Stay with us for more of Dave Makichuk's article. Each machine is roughly the size of a bus and costs a hefty $150 million. It contains 100,000 parts and 2 kilometers of cable. Shipping the equipment to customers requires 40 shipping containers, 20 trucks, and 3 Boeing 747s. Only a few companies can afford them, and most of them go to the world's 3 leading edge chip makers: the Taiwan-based TSMC, as well as Samsung in South Korea, and Intel. Jesus Del Alamo, a professor at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, says, "It is really an incredible machine." He added, "It's an absolutely revolutionary product, a breakthrough that is going to give a new lease of life to the industry for years." So what exactly is it, and what does it do? For starters, it's a game-changer, and that's putting it lightly. According to a report in Wired, built by the Dutch company ASML, Advanced Semiconductor Materials International, these extreme ultraviolet lithography machines have cornered the market for etching the tiniest nanoscopic features into microchips with light. The company's newest extreme ultraviolet system, a part of which is being built in Wilton, Connecticut, will use